I'm Jim Fleming, and this is the podcast of one segment from To the Best of Our Knowledge, Public Radio's Peabody Award-winning magazine of ideas from PRI, Public Radio International, and Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Visit Britain, with information on how to be a Brit different on vacation. More details on the web at visitbritain.com/US.
From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When was the last time you caught yourself bemoaning the day's news with a friend? Topping each other's stories of how bad things are? Being first on the block with the latest political scandal or international threat? Well, there's nothing wrong with being well-informed, of course. But do you ever wonder whether our media diet of terrorism, war, disease, and injustice is producing a kind of global fatalism?
What fatalism does is it helps absolve us from all kinds of responsibilities. It reduces shame from past failures, helps reduce our guilt, and many of us aren't even conscious that this is driving us.
We're addicted to the idea that stories aren't interesting unless they involve misery, corruption, suffering, and death. I think there's a kind of sadomasochism involved.
In this hour, we'd like to make the case for a kind of cagey optimism. For a rebellion against cynicism and pessimism, and their twin brothers, gloom and doom, we'll meet some radical optimists and some hopeful rebels and see if we can convince you that too much bad news is boring. A couple of years ago, Danny Wallace decided to drop the word no from his personal vocabulary. First, this was just a little private experiment, meant to last a day or two. But somehow, Danny wound up making a commitment to say yes to everything for a year. Danny Wallace, by the way, is the guy who started the Join Me cult, in which he got thousands of people around the world to join him for, well, for nothing, just to join. In his year of saying yes, Danny won $45,000, joined a group that believes aliens built the pyramids, got a nursing degree, lost $45,000, and traveled to a lot of places he didn't really want to go. He told Steve Paulson how it all started.
It started really because I'd been saying no a lot. I got into a groove where I was just sitting at home, really, and watching TV and eating toast and ordering takeaway. And my friends were always saying, you know, come out, there's this thing on tonight, you should come out. And I just kept saying no, and eventually it became a kind of habit. No matter what they were asking, instantly my reaction would be, I can't, I'm doing a thing, or I'm a bit busy, or I'm tired. And gradually it just meant that I was spending a lot of time essentially doing nothing. And then one day something happened where I just thought, actually, I know how to get out of this. Yes is the way to get out of this.
What happened that one day? I mean, what changed your thinking?
Well, I've never been someone who's kind of afraid to talk to strangers and things like that. And one night on a bus, I'd essentially got talking to this guy, and he managed to say something to me that, for him, I think was probably just a sentence. You know, he says it, he forgets it, he moves on with his life. And all he'd really said was, you should say yes more. And it was those three words. It was say yes more. And it kind of hit me. I thought, well, that's brilliant. That's every self-help book in the world ever written, distilled into three words. You could essentially go into any bookshop and throw out an entire section of books and just replace them with a small sign that says say yes more, because it's about positivity, about taking a chance, about actually doing something.
So you meet a guy on a bus, he says three words to you, and it changes your life for a year.
Yeah, and I always feel a bit guilty because I talk about him like he's this kind of spiritual shaman sent into the world to dispense wisdom to, you know, simpletons like me. He was just a bloke. That's all it was, really. But it was those three words, and I just thought, yeah, well, that's it. You know, if something's going to happen to you, if you're going to do things again, if you're going to meet new people, do new things, go to new places, you have to actually do something. It won't happen to you if you're sitting at home watching TV. So I decided I'm going to say yes to pretty much everything.
Now, I can imagine saying yes to a few things. I mean, basically opening myself up to more experiences, but to everything? I mean, saying yes to every question that comes along, that's kind of frightening.
It depends how you treat it. It became slightly frightening. I thought it was going to be easy because I thought, well, I'll do it for a day. I'll have a day of relentless positivity and see what happens. So the first thing that happens is the phone rings the next morning. And I've decided, you know, this is going to be it. This is the first thing, my first contact with the world outside. And it was a cold call, you know, where someone rings you up and tries to sell you something. And it just went, Mr. Wallace? And I went, yes. And it was my first yes. It was going well. And he said, "Hi, I'm just phoning from Mark 1 Double Glazing in London. Just wondered if you'd like a free, no-obligation quote for double glazing on your windows." And I went, "Yes." And I think it's the first time anyone had ever said yes to this man in his life before. He was bewildered. Before, he didn't really know what was going on. He kind of went, "Really?" And I went, "Yes." And he went, "This is great. We should organise some kind of meeting." And I went, "Yes." And he went, "Wow, okay. Well, when's good for you?" I went, "When's good for you?" He said, "Tuesday." I went, "Yes." He said, 2 o'clock. And I went, "Yes." And then I looked around my flat and I kind of realised that I already have double glazing on all my windows. So I had to kind of go, the thing is, I've already got double glazing on my windows. And he went, "What?" And I went, "I'm just saying, I've already got double glazing on all my windows, but, you know, you can still come round, still give me a quote, we can have a cup of tea, talk about the weather." And he went, "Are you wasting my time?" And I went, "Yes." So I realised there and then that actually, you know, saying yes to everything could be a nightmare and could, like you say, be frightening. And that was when I had to hone it, and I decided I won't just say yes willy-nilly to everything. So I'll say yes to favours and suggestions and requests and basically all the little things that fly at every single one of us every single day. And one thing we've got in London is a lot of people who stop you on street corners and they've got a little clipboard and they basically say, "Have you got a couple of minutes to just talk about saving the whales?" And I would have to say yes. I think I've probably saved an entire whale on my own.
Now, did you ever get scammed?
I did, yes. But, I mean, the weird thing was, you know, you kind of know from these email scams that something dodgy is afoot, something is not right. I knew that I hadn't won, say, the Spanish lottery, because I'd never entered it, and I knew that I hadn't won $240 million. But it was about following up these opportunities and just seeing where they lead you, and one time it led me to Amsterdam, and of course it turned out to be a scam, but I ended up in Amsterdam, and I was in Amsterdam for an evening that I wouldn't normally, I would have usually been sitting in front of the TV at that time of night. So I just made the best of it and had a great time, met some new people, just had a really weird and surreal kind of evening.
What happened in your weird, surreal evening?
In Amsterdam? Well, I kind of thought, look, I'm here, I should do something. The cheese museum was closed, as I found out. And so I said to someone, "Look, what would you do in your city if, you know, if you were me?" And he said, "I'll show you." And that was when I realised it could have gone wrong. Amsterdam is, of course, you know, one of the most liberal cities in the world. It's basically a city of yeses. Everything goes. At one point, I ended up in a gay leather bar, which is fine, although it is a very dangerous place for a straight man who's decided to say yes to everything. It's one of those moments you kind of suddenly realise, maybe I'm out of my depth here. It was fine. We ended up going to like a coffee shop down the road, a smart shop, they call it. And what they do is they have these legal drugs which are supposed to enhance your memory or your state of well-being or your confidence or anything like that. And the guy kind of said, "Well, you know, you should try this. It's called a psychotropic mind bomb." And that was basically my clue, thinking I shouldn't be doing this. Anything called a psychotropic mind bomb probably is. Not like ordering a latte. There's something wrong here. But I tried it. It went in. And I kind of went around for the rest of the evening thinking I had a small talking dog on my shoulder. Which wasn't in itself a bad thing. He was quite witty. You know, he'd chip in with things every now and again. So it was one of those things where at least I came home having had a new experience, one that I never have to repeat.
Now, did you work out little systems where you could not say no, but avoid certain situations by steering the subject in another way? I mean, so you didn't break your rules, but somehow
you didn't commit in the gay leather bar. No, in the gay leather bar, I suddenly became extremely talkative and I was suddenly dominating the conversation and not really allowing anyone to say anything. You know, I'm not saying that anyone would have, you know, propositioned me, but it was just that kind of thing where I thought, I'll just keep talking very quickly about anything that comes into my head. There's a nice place, I like the curtains, there's new shoes, I like them, yeah, so Amsterdam's nice, blah, blah, blah. Just keep it going. And most of them were just things like, you know, do you fancy a drink tonight? Or do you fancy going to this party that you wouldn't normally have gone to because it's going to take you 3 hours to get there and it's going to probably be rubbish? I mean, essentially, you can spin any of them into a positive, if you like, no matter how annoying they were to do at the time. I always learnt something or something good happened or I met someone new. That's kind of what happens in life.
Now, did I hear that you actually met your fiancé during this year?
Yeah, I'd met her before then, but it was only through, you know, yes, that kind of anything really happened. And so, yeah, without spoiling the end of the adventure for anyone, I mean, there is a pretty big yes at the end.
But, I mean, you're saying that things would not have progressed as far as they did without your saying yes?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Certainly not in the way they did and certainly not at that time. It's just, you know, yes is a very powerful word. And I don't know, by saying yes, you become a more interesting person because you've got more to talk about and you take more risks. Yes is a word of risk. No is a word of comfort. And no is a word which means nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to be different because you're closing yourself off in this little circle, this little protective bubble of no. But when you say yes, that's when you step out of that circle and you put yourself up to the whims of life.
You got to join, join Danny. You got to join, join Danny. Oh, you got to join, join Danny, that's me. You got to join me, join Danny.
Danny Wallace really does suggest you join him in relentless positivity. Not all the time, maybe just, you know, once a week. Steve Paulson talked with Danny Wallace, and if you want to know more, you can read Danny's book about his experience. It's called Yes Man.
Join Danny, because tonight we're going to party like it's 1983. Very good year for me. I was 7 years old, enjoyed it a lot. Join me, please. Join me. What if you? I promise it'll be great. It's not a cult, it's a collective. Please, join me.
Since September 11th, conventional wisdom says the world is going to hell in a handbasket. But is it? Not necessarily. That's how Nicole Ann Boyer began a controversial recent posting on worldchanging.com. Boyer's a strategic foresight specialist who works with international corporations, NGOs, and governments. She spends a lot of time in boardrooms, helping clients come up with realistic projections of the future so they can design strategies to meet it. She says the hardest part of her work is convincing people that their negative assessments of the world are wrong. For instance, take the recent Human Security Report. Commissioned by the UN, it found that since the end of the Cold War, violent conflicts around the world have actually gone down by 40%. Steve Paulson reached Nicole Boyer in Paris and asked how people are responding to this news.
Oh my goodness, complete disbelief, anger. How dare you? And it's coming from all kinds of sources, from my NGO friends and activists to conservative, more right-wing people. They don't want to believe it.
They don't want to believe it. That suggests that they are invested in the gloomy view of the world.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of complicated reasons why that is. And we're getting a better understanding of this thanks to some of the research coming out of the cognitive science world. But there's some very crass political reasons why they're vested in a negative interpretation of the world as well. You know, there's agendas to be defended.
Explain that. Let's start with the politics. Why is it in the interest of political leaders and opinion makers to actually play up the danger?
Look at the history of politics. You know, leaders have been able to, you know, defend their agenda and their choices by pointing to the uncertainty of the outside world and all of that. And then on the activist end of the spectrum, there's budgets to secure as well. You know, if you're a humanitarian aid activist, it's much easier to say, you know, all the world is going to hell in the handbasket. And I sympathize with them.
Hmm. Now, you suggested that there might also be something about how our brains are wired that would make us pay more attention to the gloom and doom scenarios.
Yeah, this is where some of the great research is coming in from different disciplines. So I would say the first piece of research is coming from the paleontologists who study how the brain has adapted over time. And what we're finding is our brain really took, you know, its first cognitive leap during the last ice age, when there was a lot of uncertainty and rapid change in our environment. And so a lot of people think that we're hardwired to think about the negative scenarios or to think about what if. You know, what if this woolly mammoth tiger comes running to get me at this moment, or, you know, this ice shelf collapses on me, what would I do?
Well, it would seem that the what if scenario would be very useful. And obviously, human beings have done quite well over the thousands of years that we've been around. But it sounds like you're saying that maybe that's outdated thinking, that we need to somehow develop a more optimistic way of seeing the world.
Well, we need both. You know, we need both adaptive strategies about how to see the world, and that means being able to look at the brutal facts. And the optimistic side helps us see creative strategies. Going back to the other piece of research that's really helping us understand this is, for instance, the psychology of risk. We can actually see in our brain now, when we're in a depressive state, very little activity. I think we've all experienced this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, everything seems impossible. There's no options. Whereas we can track now, When we're in a more optimistic state, we see many more options. And so we tend to make better decisions.
Well, it seems that the whole idea of decline is so entrenched in the Western world and the way we think. And to think of all those books that have come out really over the last couple of hundred years saying that the world is going to pieces. And for whatever reason, it seems that a lot of people want to buy into that scenario.
It's a deep idea that's not just in Western society, you know, the whole idea of the doctrine of fatalism. And what fatalism does is it helps absolve us from all kinds of sins and responsibilities. It reduces shame from past failures. You know, fatalism helps reduce our guilt. And many of us aren't even conscious that this is driving us.
Now, you are a futures forecaster. You work with a lot of global corporations. You work with governments. You work with NGOs. You try to plot out strategies for the future. I'm assuming that you come up against these entrenched attitudes that there is not a positive future. And I'm wondering what kind of responses you get.
Well, almost always we do get people thinking that way. But when you get them to actually go out and create different scenarios, different possibilities in a plausible way, they're always surprised.
Can you give me an example of this, how this has worked with one particular company that you've dealt with?
The most famous story of scenario planning is actually about South Africa.
Okay.
And it helped actually bring an end to a peaceful end to apartheid. And what happened was in the early 90s in South Africa, it was a transition period. Mandela was just released from jail, and the white government, the de Klerk government, had really no legitimacy. And so there's lots of confusion, and things were in flux. And they put together this scenario project called the Mount Fleur scenarios, which happened in a place called Mount Fleur. And they brought together bitter-to-death enemies, everyone from the ultra-right-wing militant factions to still exiled ANC leaders to average professionals who wanted a better future for South Africa. Because back then, things were incredibly bleak. If you think about it, no one thought there would be a peaceful solution to South Africa.
Right. I mean, that's one of the most remarkable political developments of the last century, that somehow they managed to make this transition without a major civil war.
And this process was a key part of that. And what happened was they got together and they tried to imagine various scenarios, plausible scenarios for the future of South Africa. And it took a while to build the trust in the team, but eventually they did it. And they came up with four scenarios. The first one was called Ostrich, very evocatively named, which is basically about the white government putting its head in the sand and civil war breaking out and it just being not a very nice world. The second scenario was called Lame Duck, you know, sort of a paralysis situation, right? Mm-hmm. That they wouldn't get enough agreement on either side between the white and the black government, and so the government would be paralyzed to do anything. The third scenario was called Icarus, after the Greek mythological character, and it was a scenario about economic populism. Remember, some of the ANC leaders were schooled in communist ideology, and there was a concern that they would have these big public spending programs that would basically bankrupt the government and prevent long-term investment. Well, the last scenario, the most intriguing, was called the Flight of the Flamingos. And it was actually a positive scenario, although at the time, they didn't go out of their way to make it a positive scenario. It was one of four plausible scenarios. And just like a flight of flamingos taking off, if you've watched them, it's amazing. It takes a while. There may be some stragglers on the edges, but eventually they do all take off together. It became clear to everyone that this was the only scenario people wanted to live in, regardless of their ideological background or their history. It was a great way to start putting the past behind them. This was one of the many processes that helped convince de Klerk to start entering negotiations with the ANC.
Now, it would seem, though, that there are potential pitfalls to being overly optimistic. I mean, you could make the argument, for instance, that President Bush had a very rosy picture of what was going to happen in Iraq by going into war, that, you know, send in the American troops, take over the country, and it will be transformed.
Absolutely. I think optimism can be a very special form of denial as well. and could be very dangerous. That's why I like the approach of looking at scenarios, is it helps you see both the up and the downside. It helps you develop a more sophisticated sense of what you can change, what you have to prepare for, and what you can influence. It helps you challenge your assumptions, which is, I think, key to being a successful person.
Nicole Ann Boyer is a strategic foresight specialist who also writes for worldchanging.com. Steve Paulson reached her in Paris. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. You've been listening to a segment from PRI's To the Best of Our Knowledge, Public Radio's Peabody Award-winning magazine of ideas. If you would like to hear the program in its entirety, visit ttbook.org or check with your local public radio station. You can also download the entire hour at audible.com/ttbook.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.